It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the cinemas and on DVD. Get ready for...
Wait for it!
Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Sozi!
No, that's Matthew Sozi.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's find out how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sozi.
I want a party. I want a samba.
Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the point, and I am not Matthew Sozi. Matthew is on assignment doing secret important things, which we cannot divulge to his audience, but rest assured, they are secret and important. But I'm Christopher Lloyd, here from the Film Yep, standing in for Matthew this week and next week. You can also hear me, and I've enlisted to help fill Matt's shoes because... one man cannot fill his shoes. You need two of us. We've got Ed Johnson-Ott, our friend from Nouveau News Weekly.
Good evening, Chris, and it's always nice to be here. The only time I'm invited is when Matthew's gone, because Matt and I have a deep and abiding personal hate.
But we do miss Matthew, and...
You do.
But, you know, we are merry men here, but it actually is a sad occasion here for the film world. I'm sure probably everybody knows by now that the great Roger Ebert is now the late great Roger Ebert, passing away, I don't want to say unexpectedly, but, you know, considering he had, I think, just 2 days before announced, you know, what he was going to be doing with his time at the recurrence of his cancer there at the Chicago Sun-Times, that he was going to be still reviewing but taking a step back, a leave of presence, as he called it. So I think everyone was sort of geared up to see less of him in the paper and elsewhere. And then, of course, boom, all of a sudden, he ups and dies. I mean, if you read his wife Chaz's very moving description of his passing, yeah, where he simply said he just, you know, they were at hospice getting ready to go home, and he literally just, as he said, looked at us, smiled, and quietly passed away.
Not too long ago, he wrote a piece looking ahead to his own mortality.
Yeah.
And he was not a religious man. And what a good piece of writing. Just what a really, really good piece of writing.
Well, that's that phrase right there is a good way to sum up Ebert's life. For those of you who haven't read it, I think it's back free online, back from behind the paywall of Esquire magazine, is the story that was done about, I think, 2.5, 3 years ago. This was the thing where they, you know, revealed the photos of what he really looks like now, and
right,
the physical challenges of, you know, losing his voice and everything else, the ability to speak. But, you know, they talked in there about, you know, Roger Ebert is dying, you know, in pieces, just like the rest of us. And I mean, so we've also been sort of been set up for this moment for a while, but I guess still we didn't really expect it to be happening anytime. If you haven't read that Esquire piece, it's quite lengthy but quite illuminating, and it talks about his writing process, which is basically just the man was a natural writer, you know, that he would, you know, just breeze, you know, go watch a movie, breeze into the newsroom back when he was still regularly going into the newsroom there, and just, you know, talk it up with people, socialize, and just sit down and, you know, in an hour, bang out a brilliant review. He was just a natural-born writer, and he wrote in so many different formats. Obviously, film criticism was what he was known for literally almost 50 years, but, you know, he wrote blog posts, wrote about politics, wrote about life, wrote a cooking book. He has a cooking book about how to cook with a rice cooker, and obviously last year, or now 2011, his autobiography came out called simply Life Itself. The guy was just a natural communicator through the written word.
And if you're a fan of film, Ebert's little glossary of movie cliches,
yeah,
what an amazing book, and funny and useful, and it's an education all unto itself. Really
yeah.
good piece.
And the great movies, something he started doing about, I think, 15 years ago, where it was like re-reviewing movies that he'd seen decades earlier, you know,
yep.
what he thought about them then, what he thought about them now. Also, Unheralded was distributed by his syndication service for many years, although I think he gave it up a few years ago, was the Movie Answer Man column, where I think every other week people would just throw bizarre questions about movies at him, you know, from trivia to, but also more substantial things. I always found that captivating. I think he ended up putting one of those into book forms.
Yeah.
By the way, what a racket. Which I've done myself, where you take all your old stuff, put it together, call it a book, write an intro and a foreword. Man, got to do more of that. Well,
oh, and his I hated that movie.
Yeah, we're a collection of nothing but very negative reviews. I think he ended up doing a sequel to that, probably spawned by one of the most infamous anti-reviews ever, which was of the. Was that the Ace, not Ace Ventura, what was the one with Rob from Saturday Night Live?
Rob Schneider, Deuce Bigelow.
The Deuce Bigelow. I think it was might have been the Deuce Bigelow sequel. And if you read the review, he hardly talks about the movie at all. It's a review of the reviewing process of the movie, where basically, you know, the movie got an early, very negative review from an Los Angeles critic. Rob Schneider took out a full-page ad in the paper denouncing the guy. Including where he claimed that the guy had never won any awards for his film criticism. So Ebert had the afterwards basically saying, you know, you got everything wrong. The guy has won awards. You know, at first I thought, you know, you could dish it out, but you can't take it. Turns out you can't dish it out either because you got this wrong. And where he ended up saying, as it happens, I have won the Pulitzer for film criticism and your movie sucks. So it was just the most epic takedown you've ever seen in your life.
What's the your favorite slam of your own
that I've done?
Yeah,
probably one that I liked it, but almost no one else did because I actually got negative letters to the editor was about it. Was I can't even remember. I think it was called The Big Bounce. It was a terrible, terrible movie with Owen Wilson and a bunch of other people. It was quite obviously that the guys had just made the movies as a way they could have a vacation on the beach while filming it. And the movie was so awful, and I literally did like 2.5 to 3 paragraphs in the review and just stopped the review and said, I'm stopping this review because the movie is so bad, I don't even want to waste... I've already wasted my time watching it and thinking about it, now I don't want to waste more of your time writing about it, so you have to read about it. So I said, let's pick another topic and talk about that for a while. That was probably my favorite, where I didn't so much slam the movie as I was just completely dismissive of it. How about you?
There was a movie called Big Trouble. I actually got cited in a newspaper article about memorable bad reviews for this. For the movie Big Trouble, I suggested that the audience would be better served had they released the outtakes theatrically and put the movie as a bonus feature on the DVD.
Yeah. I'd like to read a couple of things to give you a little taste of Roger's written work. This is from his great movie review of Empire Strikes Back. I think this is wonderful because... When I first started out in film criticism, which was due in no small part to Roger Ebert,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was very much one of these guys that tried to really conquer you with language, to just, you know, sort of, you know, find as many vocab words as possible as I could throw into things and just, you know, construct these long, elaborate run-on sentences and just empower you with my mastery of, you know, wordsmithing.
Right.
And... Over time, I came to realize that really was not that valuable for the reader, which is what this is supposed to be about. It should be, and I very much come more to this the Ebert method of, you know, clear language where you're not trying to dazzle, but you're showing your understanding of the movie rather than your ability to sort of do these, you know, linguistic calisthenics.
If there's more than one word in your review that a reasonably intelligent reader has to look up,
yeah.
you're just showing off.
Yeah. So let me show you, read from his Ebert's great movie review of Empire Strikes Back, because there's not, it's clear, simple language, but boy, doesn't he just get to the essence of the movie. In the glory days of science fiction, critics wrote about the sense of wonder. That's what the Empire Strikes Back creates in us. Like a lot of traditional science fiction, it isn't psychologically complex or even very interested in personalities, aside from some obvious character traits. That's because the characters are not themselves, they are us. We are looking out through their eyes instead of into them, as we would in a more serious drama. We are on a quest, on a journey, on a mythological expedition. The story elements in the Star Wars trilogy are as deep and universal as storytelling itself. Watching these movies, we're in a receptive state like that of a child. Our eyes and ears are open, we're paying attention, and we are amazed.
Nice.
Isn't that just wonderful? Yeah. I mean, here's another one from his At the Time review, which is even more impressive because it's always, I think, able, when you're looking at a movie 20 or 30 years later, where you've really had time to think about it and absorb it, you can say some pretty nice, profound things. But, you know, when the movie just came out and you watch the screening and, you know, you might have, you know, that night have to bang out a review, it's tougher to be more profound and understand a movie. But here's his movie review of American Beauty back in 1999. The performances all walk the line between parody and simple realism. Thora Birch and Wes Bentley are the most grounded, talking in the tense, flat voices of kids who can't wait to escape their homes. Annette Bening's character, a real estate agent who chants self-help mantras, confuses happiness with success. Bad enough if you're successful, depressing if you're not. And Kevin Spacey, an actor who embodies intelligence in his eyes and his voice, is the right choice for Lester Burnham. He does reckless and foolish things in this movie, but he doesn't deceive himself. He knows he's running wild, and chooses to, burning up the future years of an empty lifetime for a few flashes of freedom. He may have lost everything by the end of the film, but he's no longer a loser. Boy, I mean, as a writer, I mean, I just sort of have to just sort of, you know, sit back in awe of writing like that because, you know, it's just amazing that he can just grasp a movie so completely and relate it to the reader mm-hmm. so simply, you know, in an extemporaneous fashion, you know, as the movie has come out. He just saw it and he's reviewing it and boom. I mean, he understood in his first review of this film, he understood it as well as anybody else who's, you know, written academic articles about it over the last 10 years.
Well, you know, while he certainly wasn't the pioneer of this, he was an early, you know, he set a great example of how to review a movie without being overly scholarly or without falling into the cute thing where you're doing puns on the, based on the title of the film and what so many bad critics do. You know, I mean, he wrote clear and he assumed that you were as well-versed as he was. Yeah, again, it wasn't excessively scholarly. He wasn't showing off for anybody. He was just writing, you know, for other people that love movies.
Yeah. Now, as you might expect, there's been a lot of, you know, my experiences with Roger Ebert postings and articles over the last day or so. One by a fellow by the name of Will Leitch. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. L-E-I-T-C-H. Read his. In that. It was interesting that he went to the same college that Roger did and got some early help in his career, and then for whatever reason decided to turn on him and insult him and sort of gives the behind-the-scenes goings-on of how that went down, which basically shows that Ebert was as nice as advertised, even, you know, when being called very nasty names. Mm. I can't say as I have a whole bunch of experience with it. I exchanged a few emails with Roger probably about 10 or 11 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Were basically probably like, you know, a million other people, young film critics trying to get somewhere in their career, looking for some advice and maybe an endorsement or something like that. And he told me something which was, you know, depressing but true, was at the time I just probably won my first big journalism award for my film criticism. I was very happy about it, and I was trying to, frankly, parlay it into something bigger. And he just said, yeah, you know, editors don't care about awards. He's like, unless you've, you know, actually, like, won the Pulitzer, it's not going to get you anywhere in your career. No one's going to give you more money or hire you for a job for it. And he was right.
Well, Siskel gave him static about the Pulitzer, too.
Yeah, well, because he was tremendously jealous. I have a fellow by the name of Rick Allen that I work with down in Florida. He had a personal working relationship with Siskel for many years, where he literally spoke with him on the phone almost every day. and got to know him and be friendly with him. And, you know, Siskel and other people have reported this, so it's not like it's some big revelation that, you know, Siskel openly expressed, you know, regret that he never won a Pulitzer and equaled his great friend and rival.
He's on one of the shows, Ebert made a passing reference to his Pulitzer and said, you know, I'm the only critic that that's won one. And Siskel said, you're the only critic so full of yourself to submit for one.
Yeah, it was one of those. It was a very green-eyed affair. He pretended not to care, but Siskel cared very much. And I like Siskel, and I read his stuff, but I think he grasped film as well as Roger did. He just was not that natural born writer like Ebert was. Like very very few of us are.
Right.
Well, that gives us an occasion. I did want to mention that, you know, with his illness, which has been going on for, you know, 7 or 8 years now, there had been some, he's still been very prolific with a few big spans, gaps where obviously where he was recuperating from surgery and such, but it had been commented in within the film, the community within the community of film critics talking to each other that he had had some issues, some errors in his reviews over the last decade or so, where he just said things that weren't true, you know, describe usually where he was describing the plot, you know, he would assert something that didn't actually happen or, you know, the way he misremembered it. I often saw him, he would write a, you know, long paragraph, long quote attributed to a character that, you know, that he got absolutely completely right, but then he would attribute it to the wrong character, saying like the mother said this when it was actually, you know, the sister or something like that. So, you know, I'm not going to sit here and, you know, badmouth him a day after his death and, you know, say that he lost his fastball or anything like that, because I think he still had it right up to the end. But he showed us that he was human, even as a writer there in those last few years.
There was a period where, after his illness, where he went from being a pretty consistent writer to being pretty erratic. And it was, you stopped reading him as a gauge for whether you might enjoy the film. You still read him because he was such a great writer. But he was pretty erratic for a while, and then he kind of leveled out, and or maybe I just got adjusted to the new style. But well, whatever it was, you know, it was more fun to read him on a regular basis again.
Right, I agree. I think the last 3 years, three years, he was pretty much, not 100%, but he was, you know, 90-95% back on his game. You're right. There was a period there where it was pretty erratic. It's what people often say about a great athlete is consistency. Is, you know, it's not that, you know, like in a like a NBA basketball player, you know, like it's not that they can't go out and do that 20-point, 10-rebound game. It's just that instead of it being an every night thing, now it's an, you know, it becomes an every other game thing. Then it becomes a once in a while thing. And so for a while there, he had gone from being a, you know, sort of a great player to a pretty good player. But I think he was back to being a great player at the very end there.
Well, you know, the man lost his jaw too.
Yeah, people don't want to talk about.
He didn't go away, and that's what most of us would do.
He went on TV. He went on the Oprah Winfrey Show,
yeah,
and showed the world, this is what I look like now. And I mean, I saw the man in person. About 3 years ago, before he'd, you know, and I mean, you know, he was pretty cool upfront about, you know, this is what I look like now. I know it's not easy to look at least at first, but here it is.
Right.
And yeah, absolutely no shame in it.
No, and good for him. You know, I mean, it and yes, it was uncomfortable to look, but good for him for not going away, for staying there. And, you know, you can look or you can not look, but I'm not going to disappear because I've got a new disability.
Yeah. Well, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the way in which most people knew Roger. And this is how I first encountered him as a kid, was watching the TV show.
Absolutely.
With Siskel and Ebert, which I think, you know, people talked about Pauline Kael and Andrew Saris back in the 60s and 70s with their Great War. But I really think Roger and Ebert did more for the modern state of film criticism than any other two people living.
So did Gene and Siskel.
Living or dead. Siskel and Ebert, yeah. Just because they brought it, they took film criticism from being this, you know, for a while it was sort of something that was just viewed as very rote, that you just sort of listed the plot and said good or not good. Then it became something that was kind of esoteric, where it was not very accessible, where critics saw themselves as being very much above their audience. And I think they really kind of collectively brought it, and they brought it literally into your home. And it just became two guys that you liked arguing with each other about movies.
And, you know, I mean, it went, what was so beautiful was that we had not, movie criticism became not just the romantic comedy that opened this week or the action film, but also the film from Budapest.
Yeah.
And the little art film about the little girl in Iran looking for her lost money.
Yeah.
You know, and the big films got they came first in the show, but still all the films got their due.
Yeah, they typically did five film reviews, plus a video, what's new on video, in the course of a half-hour show, which so that meant probably actually more like 23 or 24 minutes. Pretty impressive stuff. And here's the thing. People try to copy that show, and there was some success at that immediately when their contemporaries competing against it, so to speak. But then, of course, then when Siskel died and Ebert carried on the show for a while, and again, you know, not to speak ill of the dead, but it was very disappointing, you know, when he was essentially spent a year trying out replacements for Siskel, and had some very distinguished critics on the show with him, and instead chose the guy who worked down the hall,
Skippy,
Richard Roper, you know, an entertaining pop culture lifestyle columnist.
Nice man.
I think when he appeared on the show and, you know, gave his film review, that was the first film review he'd done in any format, written or broadcast. And it was just sort of like, you know, why'd you do that? And I think that's the reason why, basically, when Siskel died, not only did that show die, but I think that format died. I think the film criticism on television died because, you know, they tried to, after, you know, Ebert and Roper hung it up, they tried to recreate it with, you know, the Bens, the two young guys you've never heard of,
mm-hmm.
who were awful.
Especially the little twerpy one.
Yeah. One guy's actually gone on. He's now doing stuff on AMC.
Right.
And he's quite good at it, and good for him for having a second act.
The other one, he was from E! Television, E! Online or something.
Yeah, twerp is the best way to put it.
Oh, what a twerp.
You know, but even when they got rid of those guys, and then they said, okay, we're going the other way. We're going to get two very high-profile, well-regarded critics, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune and A.O. Scott from the New York Times, and we're going to put those guys together. And it was better, but it was really flat, and no one watched. And
no one ever did it right except for Siskel and Ebert.
Yeah, and then, of course, we had the final iteration, which was Ebert tried to recreate the show using, and again, he plucked, you know, he plucked from obscurity some 24-year-old guy from Russia.
Right.
Who wrote for, you know, some streaming movie site out there that, you know, you can, where you can pay to watch movies. And apparently they had a film critic and he was the guy who did it. And I'm not belittling him for his age, because Ebert himself was a 24-year-old nobody when he was literally picked from obscurity to be the Sun-Times movie critic. But they took him and, what's the gal from, Christy LeMire from the Associated Press.
AP.
And the Associated Press critic, who's not bad, but, you know, obviously if you're the Associated Press critic, you're writing for a very general audience, and so she writes in a very general way, and it turns out when we saw her doing broadcast, that's the way she does broadcast, and it just didn't work.
Did you see, it was on TBS, I believe, Peter Travers from Rolling Stone and Lisa Schwartzman from... Entertainment Weekly did a weekly show for a while.
No, I didn't.
She said, I think it was called.
Was it any good?
It was of all the clones, it was the worst.
Really? I actually love those two critics, so why would it be?
You had writers, not television personalities, but writers, both of whom had decided that they were going to be adorable.
Oh.
And it was all the puns based on the movie titles and all that. It was all of that. And you could see that before each film, they'd sat down and they're, all right, what's our premise for the review going to be? How are we going to be adorable this time?
Yeah.
And she did it. Well, they both did sing-songy, syrupy voice. It was horrible.
Here's so I asked a question. Now I'll answer my own question. I'll pretend I'll pretend I'm Chris Matthews. Here's why that doesn't work is because in all those cases, they were essentially, you know, we're taking somebody from one corner of the country and somebody from another corner of the country, or basically two people who didn't know each other, and saying, we're going to fly one of you in and we're going to do a show. And that doesn't work because as much as Siskel and Ebert was about movies, it was about those two guys right. and their relationship with each other, that love, great love, hate relationship. And as much as people love to hear them wax poetic about a great movie, people love to see them scrap it up and go at each other, which they did with great glee.
Yeah. And they may have hammed it up once in a while, but for the most part, it was real.
Yeah, it was.
And you felt that. The authenticity was there.
And so in order for that to work, you have to have a town in which there are two high-profile movie critics who know each other, you know, love or hate each other, whatever, but two people doing film criticism on a, you know, full-time basis, and that's what they do. And aside from New York, that just doesn't really exist anymore.
No.
I mean, even big towns, I mean, you know, Chicago, now with Ebert gone, you know, even before, you know, he was talking about his Ebert, when he talked about what he was going to be doing, he talked about having a variety of freelancers filling in, and I will bet you dollars to donuts that what ends up happening at the Sun-Times. I will bet you anything that they do not hire a full-time film critic replacement. They're just going to use Roper and the Russian guy. I can't pronounce his name. I wouldn't be surprised. So you're going to end up having Chicago going from a two-critic town to a one-critic town.
Well, how many towns even have two papers?
Not many. Even Los Angeles, you know, they have the LA Daily Times, and they had a decent critic there, and they got rid of him and layoffs and. So that's the problem, is you have to have that basis of there are two people, and more there, you know, unless you just do a New York show, there aren't any towns where there's two people anymore. And that crazy alchemy of those two guys together was, I think, as much about the success of the show as anything else. So it has to be the two right people. And you know, it's like fool's gold versus real gold. We've only seen the gold one time. Well, to finish out our honorific to Roger Ebert here, why don't we just listen in to one occasion where those two guys, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel, went at it about 22 years ago, but movie Silence of the Lambs, which, if you can believe it, Gene Siskel gave a negative review to. So let's take a listen to the last couple minutes or so of their discussion on Silence of the Lambs.
The picture involving Julia Roberts, I have it again here. I didn't learn a thing about serial killers from this movie. A much more honest, less exploitative film on the same subject was last year's Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. By contrast, The Silence of the Lambs is a star-studded freak show directed by the usually enormously talented Jonathan Demme, who I think for the first time in his career has picked a surprisingly trashy project.
Well, this is a tough film to review because, of course, in terms of its subject matter, one can easily target it, as you have. And also, I think that the ending doesn't really work. Once she gets into the house of Buffalo Bill, it does become standard who's behind this door, who's going to jump on me from the shadows. The first part of this film, though, Gene, is terrifically effective, partially because of the real tension, the dynamic interaction between Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins. It's one of the most peculiar and fascinating relationships I've seen in a movie in a long time. Hopkins is very good here. Foster is very good here. The dialogue is at a very high level of intelligence, and the movie works not perhaps in the same way as Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, but effectively. And I think that you're really shortchanging a lot of skill and craft and art that went into this film.
No. You know, sometimes you say, I think you blew it on this one. I think you're being too easy on this picture in this way. He is presented, the Anthony Hopkins character, is presented as this big evil thing, and we're going down there to see them, a journey into hell and all that. And frankly, he was so pumped up, and the music was so pumped up at such a high level.
It worked for me. It worked.
Well, then you're easy, because for me, I thought, oh, come on. A guy who's truly frightening doesn't need, a huge organ playing in the background. I didn't buy it at all.
This is the movies. What did you want? A documentary, black and white, television, shoot it on video?
The reason why Henry, the Portrait of a Serial Killer works is because these people, my intuition, I don't have any first-hand knowledge, these people tend to be kind of dull.
Well, they're two different kinds of movies, and you're using one to criticize the other.
Yes, we always do that, Roger. We say better picture than the same
subject. Why can't you criticize this on its own terms instead of saying
what it is? I'm criticizing on its own terms. I didn't, wasn't compelled by anybody except, I suppose, the Jodie Foster character as a strong woman.
Come on, a great performance.
Not a great performance, a decent performance.
Anthony Hopkins.
No,
great.
I thought that was way overplayed.
All right, that, of course, was Silence of the Lambs, which went on to win Oscars for Best Picture, Director, Screenwriter, Actor, and Actress, one of only three films to do so. And we play it not just to show how spectacularly wrong Siskel was, but...
Well, and he isn't necessarily wrong. He just has a different opinion than the majority.
Right. Well, I would say two...
Although he's wrong.
I would say two thumbs up to that that repartee, but unfortunately, Siskel and Ebert did smartly copyright that phrase they were so well known for, so we'll just say... Thanks, Roger and Gene, for the memories. We'll see you.
They will be missed.
They will be missed. Why don't we take a little break right now? We'll come back with some new movie reviews and videos.
Any good?
I don't watch movies.
Well, have you heard anything about either one of them?
I find it's best to stay out of other people's affairs.
You know who I can do without? I can do without the people in the video store.
Which ones?
All of them.
What would you get for a 6-year-old boy who chronically wets his bed?
So, do you have any new movies in?
Do you have that one with that guy who was in that movie that was out last year?
They never rent quality flicks. They always pick the most intellectually devoid movie on the racks.
Ooh, Navy SEALs!
It's like in order to join, they have to have an IQ less than their shoe size.
Just go open the video store.
Yeah, open the video store!
Blockbuster Video! Wow, what a difference!
All right, and that's the video store. It is open, but boy, it's kind of barren on the shelves this week for the new release shelves, because... As we were just discussing off-air, this is quite possibly the weakest week for video releases I've seen in a long time.
Rent Local Hero, my favorite film of all time.
Instead of what's new. But okay, we'll tell you what is new, because it's a pretty short list. Probably the most notable one is The Bible, the epic miniseries that you've probably been hearing a lot about, because it's been beating some of the network shows in its time slot, is, yes, now out on video. So go check that out if you're into the whole Bible thing. we've got classic
Well, that's going to endear you to a lot of listeners.
coming from the voice of a failed Catholic. Hello, Dolly. Was that Barbara Streisand's first big movie, Hello, Dolly? Or was that her second? I can't remember. But
I don't know.
Pretty early in her career. That's making its Blu-ray debut this week. We've got a drama with Ray Winstone called The Sweeney. I believe it's some kind of a Irish crime film, crime drama of some sort. Haven't seen it. No one else has.
And remember, you got two guys here who go to every movie we can.
Yeah, and that's haven't heard of it. And then another one, I think this one might be a straight-to-video, Hemingway and Gellhorn. starring Clive Owen and Nicole Kidman. I believe it has something to do with Ernest Hemingway.
Vaguely. And the producer of Live with Regis and Kelly.
There you go.
Yeah, okay.
So that's what we know about the video store this week. Sorry, we'd tell you what we think of these movies, but we didn't even hear of them until I was making this list for the broadcast today. So that's the video store out of the way. However,
Local Hero, rent Local Hero. It's a little film. It's a wonderful little film.
There are some new movies out in theater, and I'd just like to preface as we go into our reviews of this week's releases. I've been telling people this for the last couple of weeks, and no one seems to believe me. We are now in the summer movie season. Right now,
yes.
We are already in it. We've actually been in it for a few weeks now. I think probably the release of Jack the Giant Slayer and then Oz the Great and Powerful was it, because this thing has just kept getting shifted earlier and earlier, and then last year with the Hunger Games making a huge hit, and the
G.I. Joe was last week?
G.I. Joe came out last week.
It was Memorial Day weekend once upon a time, then they tried to inch it, get like the week, couple weekends before that, and it's just kept creeping forward to where it's now.
For the longest time, it was the first Friday in May. Everyone had accepted that for about 5, 6, 7 years, and then I think it was a couple of movies broke that, went to the last Friday in April. The Fast and Furious franchise did that a couple, 3 years ago, did really well. And then the Hunger Games, as I mentioned. And for all intents and purposes, summer starts in March now, folks.
Yeah.
So this week we do have a pretty big movie, which is The Evil Dead. It's Evil Dead.
Gonna go watch The Evil Dead?
Go
watch that Evil Dead.
Go pirate it and watch it on the internet. But yes, for those who aren't familiar, this is a remake, sort of the original film trilogy. Evil Dead came out in 1981. Then Evil Dead 2, which was billed as a sequel, but was
still dead,
was kind of more of a remake of the first one in 87. And then Army of Dead in 92 or 3. Army of Darkness, I'm sorry, in 92 or 3. All those directed by Sam Raimi, of course, better known for the Spider-Man films.
Then Dead and Electric Boogaloo.
Yep. And here he is. So this is an officially sanctioned and blessed by Sam Raimi and the gang. I think Raimi is...
Producer?
Is a producer on it. And he actually handpicked the director, who was a rookie guy, never directed a feature film before. I believe Bruce Campbell, the star of the first three films, is also a producer. So this is not some the rights expired and they bought it up and cranked out a cheap remake. This is, you know, an actual endorsed by the guys thing. So... And I believe we've got an. For those who don't know, is it right to call it a zombie movie or a demonic possession movie?
Demonic possession, not zombies.
Okay. I believe we've
Although the writing level is about the level. I would guess that zombies might have written it.
So I believe we've got an audio clip of Evil Dead. Let's take a listen.
Please.
Go to sleep.
yet.
Wow. Yes, indeedy. So for those of you who don't know the whole Evil Dead setup, it's kind of the original, not the original, but one of the early cabin in the woods horror films. Bunch of young, good-looking people are in a cabin in the woods for whatever reason. In this case, it's to help one of them kick their drug habit.
The one interesting thing in the whole movie right there.
Was the that was something that was different from the original. The other thing that's really different from, and they get taken over by demonic forces, and they encounter the Necronomicon, which is a book bound in human flesh with all these dark spells and incantations, which for some reason the guy, the intellectual guy insists that he needs to read these, which unleashes the forces.
It's nailed closed.
Yes.
Nailed, barbed wired, crazy glued closed.
In addition,
with do not read this, do not open this on it.
Yeah, yeah. Someone has written on top of the incantation, someone has written, don't read this, you will unleash hell. And so he still reads
do-de,
it.
Do-de, do-de, do. Hey, this looks like good reading.
Yeah. And apparently he's an intellectual who wears glasses, but not smart enough to read silently. In the movies, people have to read out loud in order to have comprehension of what they're reading.
Yeah.
I didn't hate this. Maybe it was just some leftover residue of my good feelings towards the originals. Because, I watched the Evil Dead movies when I was a kid, and just bathed in the schlocky goodness of them. Because they were made self-referentially as schlocky, zero budget. The first film, the second film was slightly more than zero budget, and very, very funny, intentionally so. And I think that's the one main thing that's really missing here is the puckish humor. They seem to have intentionally left that out, and I think that was a mistake.
It's one I can't rant and rave about it because I can't pull up that much emotion. It just takes time up.
Yeah.
You go pay money and have your time taken up for a while, then you go somewhere else. It's not scary. It's not scary for a moment. The people are phenomenally stupid. You can't identify with anybody. They're just these are people that if you erected a wall in a desert and put candy in all directions, they would walk into the wall.
Yeah,
that's who these people are, it's horror as goo.
Yeah. I found it a little more redeeming than that. I mean, if you're a horror fan, you will probably find this moderately engaging. If you're not a horror fan, probably not. It is very gory, like the original films. It did have a couple of things. It had has an actor in it by the name of Shiloh Fernandez, who I've been kind of semi-following for a few years. I've seen him in a lot of small independent movies at local film festivals, and I've been saying to myself, that guy could be a movie star if he gets the right role. This is not the right role for him. He's probably the most least interesting character on screen just because he has nothing to do other than he's just the guy that carries the plot forward. I also noticed from this movie, that in the previous movies, it was pretty much usually, gross people who got possessed by the demon. And here it's all hot young babes. I think there's three hot young babes who all get possessed by the demon at some point. And I don't know. No, that's right. There's three characters. Then there's the girl we saw at the very beginning, the girl in the woods. So there's four hot young babes who get possessed. And I don't know what's up with that. Is it supposed to be more scary when a pretty girl is possessed?
Hey, you're the hetero, man. You tell me. and it violates the Jason versus Freddy rule, too. I mean, Jason versus Freddy, people were all excited about that film, but it was like you have two entities that cannot be killed in a war to the death. What's wrong with this premise?
Yeah.
Well, that's the same thing we've got here. The thing cannot be stopped. It can only be slowed down.
Yeah.
And we see characters, once we see that characters can have things happen to their human bodies that our human bodies could never withstand, you stop caring. It just becomes the Roadrunner versus Wile E. Coyote versus Satan.
Yeah. The nerd character in particular has like the constitution of Rasputin. He has he gets beaten and stabbed and maimed and
nailed
and keeps coming back for more. And boy, I'm impressed. But so Ed hated it. I was kind of more in the middle, so
I'm kind of getting this out of it. I think Gina said this pretty good.
No, you just go see that in the theater, you laugh about it, and you go home.
Yeah, it's just there.
You just go see it in the theater, and your ass gets tired. That's pretty much all there is to this movie.
We're going to mention Ginger and Rosa, which is a new drama coming out. Unfortunately, neither of us saw it, but if you go to thefilmyap.com, we do have a review up by one of our people there. It's a coming-of-age British drama set during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And unfortunately, did not do so well with our reviewer here. I believe that was Patrick Mitchell from the Film Yap. Said, I really wanted to love Ginger and Rosa. I really did. And yet the first hour of this 80-minute snore was so dull, I had to prop myself up to keep from snoring. For a drama set during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which many feared meant nuclear holocaust, the stakes are remarkably low. So not a good review for Ginger and Rosa. We should also just mention in passing Jurassic Park 3D, which, of course, is a 1993 movie, now being re-released in 3D. Is this just a cynical repackaging it in 3D for a buck or what?
I saw it. The 3D's fine. You know, the main thing is it was an excuse to see it on the big screen again, and that was a treat.
Yeah.
The clunky parts of the movie are still clunky. You know, the silly stuff is still there. I'll keep this short, but my sister and I bugged my parents back when it first came out until we finally got them to go over. My dad was just notoriously fussy with movies, but we thought, how can you not love this? So they finally agree. They go over to see the film. They come home earlier than expected. And, you know, you're home early. Well, yeah. What happened? Well, my dad goes, well, the dinosaurs were just as good as you said they'd be. You liked watching the dinosaurs and stuff. He goes, well, that little boy got zapped with the 10,000 volts of electricity, and then 2 minutes later was eating food in the cafeteria. I just reached over and touched Mama's arm and said, Mama, you want to go home now? And that was it. That was his moment of, that's enough now.
Yeah, very, very funny. Okay, that doesn't make sense. I will say, I thought, you know, this is a large section of the movie is the kids in peril motif. But I like the kids in this movie.
Very much.
Because I thought they were well acted, well portrayed, and they seemed like real kids. And not only real kids, but, you know, real normal kids in extraordinary circumstances. Uh-huh. And how would they actually act? And I thought that was pretty good.
And, you know, there's so many great moments in the film beyond just the spectacle of the dinosaurs. Just so much.
My friend Roger Moore, a critic down in Florida, put it best. He says, and it features Jeff Goldblum at his gold bloomiest.
Yes. Oh, and if you do go see the film over the weekend, do yourself a little favor. When you're watching the ride, ask yourself this: had everything gone right, and on this attraction, and you'd paid your money for Jurassic Park, how furious would you be over not seeing anything after you'd flown to an island on the coast of South Africa, South America?
Yeah,
you know, it was like the worst. It was like the zoo on a balmy day.
Yeah. All right, so it's Jurassic Park now with a $3 upcharge to see it in 3D, and I believe they're actually releasing it on Blu-ray and the 3D Blu-ray just a couple weeks later. So,
wow!
If you miss it here, go do there. Let's talk about Lore. Did you see Lore?
Saw Lore, liked Lore.
Lore is a Australian-German film, which right away makes me interested in it. Film made largely by Australians, but about Germans in German. And it's sort of a very familiar World War II tale, which is people dislocated by the war and forced to go on a journey. You see all sorts of different things about that, from, you know, escape movies, prison of war movies, to, you know, like, you know, of course, how many different movies have there been there about that, where, you know, normal people or soldiers who are dislocated by the war,
right?
And, you know, in some way there's a geographical and therefore also moral pivot. And the big change here is it's instead of being about Americans or British people, it's about German children whose parents are high-ranking Nazis. And so as the war ends, they become, you know, sought-after criminals. And so they have to go on their journey to safety to their grandmother's house some 500 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, what did you think about Lore?
Well, first, I'll get myself in trouble real quickly here. Well, as far as the Australian-German production, I thought to myself, you know what? If the Nazis had Australian accents, they never would have been able to cause all this trouble, because people would have gone, oh, come on. Every time they talked, they would have started pointing at them and saying, cut the funny voice. Get back to business. Anyhow, I enjoyed the performances. I enjoyed how understated it was. I thought there were a lot of opportunities where they could have cheated and they didn't. Just from seeing films, there's things you expect it to do for you and they don't. They want you to do the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And I was okay with that. I can see where somebody might be bugged and say this is a little too deliberate. They're not giving us quite enough. But I liked what happened there. I thought it was really an interesting, challenging film.
Yeah, I thought so too.
And good acting.
Good acting from the kids, particularly I can't pronounce her name, playing Laura, the main character, who's the setup is that she's older. She's maybe 15,
yeah,
you think, or so.
Yeah, 14 or 15.
And so as the oldest, she sort of ends up becoming the de facto leader of this merry band. And, you know, I mean, there's no train service, so they're literally walking all this way, hitching rides when they can, and, you know, trying to find food and, you know, bartering their mother's jewelry for food. I think they end up trading away their mother's wedding ring for, you know, some bread or something.
Yeah.
So it's pretty harrowing stuff. It's a good film. Not a great film, but I think it's definitely worth seeing.
Now that was a good movie.
All right. I think last on our list is Six Souls, which did you see this one?
No.
I did. It's opening locally. I know because the studio bugged me that it's opening and I have to see it. And they actually gave me access to an online screener, which
is this the one where they, like, Wednesday notified us that it was opening on Friday?
Exactly. And can you review it? Well, by gosh, I did. So you can head over to thefilmyapp.com and read perhaps the only review of Six Souls existing in the universe for
all
I know.
How is it, Chris?
Not good.
What
wow,
is it? What's
not
it
good.
About?
It's about split personalities. Boy, there's not an often used and hackneyed plot vehicle, the split personality. This film was, I looked it up and read about it. It was originally titled Shelter. It had been sheltered on the shelf of some of the studio for a while. Was shot by a couple of Swedish TV filmmakers. They literally shot the film 5 years ago, starring Julianne Moore and Jonathan Rhys Meyers. And I don't think they know what to do with it. And so they just they put it out on pay-per-view a couple of weeks ago. Then they're putting it out for this modest theatrical release, and then it'll be out in video before too much longer after that. It starts out as a split personality movie. The guy who played the annoying guy Glenn on The Walking Dead, you know, the old guy who lectures everybody.
Yes.
And I think people openly cheered when his character was killed. He's in here as the dad of Julianne Moore, and they're both psychiatrists.
Are you talking about the guy that was like Judd Hirsch?
Oh, sorry, not Glenn, not the Asian American guy. The older guy who drives the Winnebago in The Walking Dead.
The one who Judd Hirsch would have been playing him if they had a bigger budget.
Yes. What was that character's name?
I thought Dale, but I'm not sure.
Dale, you're right. You're right. I'm sorry. Not kudos to Glenn at The Walking Dead. Not you're still alive.
I like Glenn.
So it's about, you know, he brings her in because she doesn't believe in split personalities as a psychiatric diagnosis. She thinks it's bunk. So the dad brings her into this case where a guy who obviously really is split personality, or is he?
Uh-oh.
Is something else going on? Because people start showing up with these weird rashes on their backs, vaguely in the shape of a cross, and they start spitting out dirt, and things happen, and he seemed to have
Evil Dead-ish.
Two personalities, and then it's three, and then it's four, and then you may know from the title what number it goes up to. and, you know, and then they end up with this excursion into hillbilly country where you've got all these people from, you know, look like they're outtakes from Deliverance, you know, looking at the city folk with surly stares and why are you coming out here to where we can perform the real magic? And could it be that the split personality is in fact the work of the devil?
Well, now you've just done gone and spoiled it for everybody.
No. It's a nice-looking movie visually that the filmmakers have skill, but boy, this is just a complete disaster of a film. Go watch it or rent it when it comes out in video in about 5 minutes just to sort of witness a change. I mean, it's got Julianne Moore, very talented actress. Jonathan Rhys Meyers, some good talent here, and boy, having good talent is no guarantee because what a disaster.
Also, this weekend, if you don't have any plans, it's okay if you don't.
IU Cinema tonight, 9:30. Like Someone in Love, 2013 drama, foreign language. Tomorrow, 3:00, the 2009 animated film Ponyo.
Oh boy!
Anybody see it?
Oh yeah, back in the day.
In the day, 4 years ago.
Was it really just 4 years old?
2009.
Wow, I thought it was more like 2004.
Which one was that?
That was, I can't pronounce his name, the Japanese filmmaker, Miyakawi, is that how you pronounce it? I just butchered it. See, I should have just said, I'm not going to try and pronounce it and stuck with it. But no, then I went for it and, yeah, I'm sorry.
6:30 tomorrow night, IU Cinema Poetry from 2010. 9:30, again, Like Someone in Love this year. Sunday, 3:00, Real Engine, 2009 documentary. And 6:30, Sunday evening, IU Cinema, The Chicago Conspiracy. Tonight, the silent film series with live musical accompaniment rolls on at the Indianapolis Museum of Art with The Matrimaniac and The Missing Millionaire from 1917.
Wow. Good stuff for the ardent film lover.
And one more thing. Mark your calendar. We're telling you about it a week in advance so we don't come at you next week and, oh, we can't go because we got plans already. Well, April 13th, Sammy Terry's Nightmare Theater stage show in Seymour.
Wow.
Yes. Is this Sammy Terry or Sammy Terry Jr.?
This is Sammy Terry.
Okay.
Wow. Except no substitutes or facsimiles. Well, we did want to mention briefly, we've got just a few minutes left. We obviously used the first part of the show for our honorarium for Roger Ebert. But actually, some other fairly significant people in the film world passed along this past week. So it's that feature known once again as Dead People We Like.
Wait a minute. The thing. I've got the thing here. Hang on. Oh, man. There it is.
These are doing our the annual show of Dead People We Like.
There's a pretty big one this
week. We don't have time for Dead People We Don't Like.
Yes. We should re-record a new one of that because it starts out with me with a mistake with me saying it's time for our annual show like you do it. We do it once a year instead of once
a
week.
We need some intro music and then we need some background music to do the opus.
Should it be like, for something portentous like Dead People, should it be like the Inception, like bum, 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 da,
dong.
I don't know. We'll just mention them in passing. We've got Valery Zolotukhin, Russian actor, probably best known for the Night Watch film from a few years ago and the sequel Day Watch. We've got Jesus Franco, who was sort of a Spanish schlock horror filmmaker, did Count Dracula and a few other films, I think, there in the 60s. Milo O'Shea, Irish character actor. One of those that guys who you probably haven't heard the name, but if you saw the face, you would be like, oh, yeah.
Oh,
very big
guy.
In the 60s through 80s. Was the friar in Romeo and Juliet. Was also in Barbarella, Purple Rose of Cairo, The Butcher Boy. Probably my favorite role of his, the judge in the great courtroom drama The Verdict with Paul Newman, which is, as we speak, sitting number one in my rental queue in Netflix. And, of course, we have to mention, sorry again if I butcher the name, Ruth Prower Jabvala, novelist and screenwriter, best known for her collaborations with the Merchant Ivory film guys. So she did the screenplays for Howard's End, Remains of the Day, Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, Room with a View, racked up 3 Oscar nominations and 2 wins, if you can believe it.
Wow.
So, Ed, what's going on in Ed World?
I'm going to Radio tonight to see Bigger Than Elvis and a bunch of rockabilly acts playing with them, but Bigger Than Elvis is always the best group.
Awesome.
Uh-huh. And I'm going to take a nap at some point.
Well, I have got my niece in town with me, and she was actually going to join us here on the show. She came to the Evil Dead screening on Tuesday night, but unfortunately not feeling too well.
She only agreed to do it so she can get to the Evil Dead screen.
I know. That's the way it is.
Once she used Uncle Chris, she's amped straight and she's out partying.
Yeah, and then I think we're going out to a Japanese steakhouse that we've not been to before, and then I'm determined to make, because this is my niece's last night in town, she's leaving tomorrow, so I'm determined to make her a special dessert, so I'm making her apple hand pies tonight. So wish me luck.
Are you going to the Japanese
hand pies? Okay. It's like it's an apple turnover.
Are you going to the Japanese steakhouse, the real famous one?
No, the slightly less famous one.
Okay, because if it's the real famous one, get the tuna.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
You have been listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm Christopher Lloyd. I'll be back next week.
I'm Ed Johnson, not from Newsweek Weekly. I won't be anywhere close until Matt Soucy goes on the road again.
As Matt would say, go see a good movie. You deserve it.
What about saying hi to Kobe?
I'm here.
He's going to do his...
We gone! Good night, Fort Myers.